So, how was your week?
I've been okay. Yeah. So I
Yeah,怎么样？What's
had my
news? Tell me.
first mammogram,
Oh.
an
Oh,
ultrasound
yeah,
on
对。
Monday. Yeah.
How
And
was it?
it was awkward. Strange.
Remember
how mom used to tell us that,
Yeah.
oh, it's so painful. They
I
squeeze
know.
your
Yes,
boobs
I
so
know. I
hard.
remember. Yep.
Yeah. But it
So.
was okay. It was just feeling tight. Yeah.
So I grew up thinking that I had to do it like every year. I still haven't had my breasts checked ever.
Oh, you can get the GP to check, like,
Oh, right.
if your GP is a female, obviously.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. My GP's an Asian woman.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have it any other way. And
Okay.
also, my therapist is an Asian woman as well. Because the
Oh,
older I get, the more I realize I'm only comfortable with my own kind of person,
that's
you
so
know?
funny. That is so funny because I was listening to another Asian podcast.
Yeah.
They're Americans,
Yeah.
and they all say that their family doctor, they call it family doctor, yeah, the family doctors are all Asians as well, and they're like second gen. They're second gen. They were born there. They were not. They're not even like us who were born overseas. Yeah, they feel like they're inclining to the Asian doctors appeals to them. They feel like they know them better.
And honestly, it's true. And the thing is, like, if you like, I'm just thinking, like, a white guy going to see another, who's his doctor being another white guy. No one would think anything of it, you know? Like, that's kind of like, yeah, the default, kind of like, yeah, that's normal. But if I like go around saying I specifically want an Asian woman, you know, like, yeah, it's just,
Everyone will question your choice.
well, like, yeah, it'll be like, oh, why? Like, why is that so important to you? And I think, like, I think I'm just trying to think. All my life, I think I've definitely only had female doctors. Before I had the current one, who's an Asian woman, I had an Italian woman in Bondi for several years. But the only circumstance where I find myself with a male doctor is, and it has happened several times in my life, is when I've had to see a specialist. And I've had to see so many specialists in my life. When I had like a hemorrhage thing, I had to see a butt doctor, and he was an old white guy. And when I've had like gastroenterologists check my stomach for holes, because like throughout my 20s, I've had issues with like anemia, and like they thought that there was a hole in my stomach.
Yeah, you
That's
had
where the
ulcers
blood
and
was
reflux and
leaking. Yeah, white guy, like a lot of sort of like men tend to be in the sort of specialist areas, and I don't have the capacity to say, oh, I only want to see an Asian woman.
because you don't get the choice.
Yeah, exactly. You get
You have to
barely.
wait for months to see a specialist in Australia.
I
So
know, exactly.
it's
And these
very
specialists are
limited.
so limited in their capacity to see people. Yeah, exactly. So but I've been very lucky. I've been very lucky with these two Asian women who I see, these medical specialists.
Yeah, I think all my doctors are all female, even with ones that I had to see gastroenterologist.
Gastroenterologist,
Yeah,
yeah.
I don't know what's a specific term for it. Yeah, she's an Asian woman as well, which is a bit surprised to me because this is like almost 7, 8 years ago up on the coast here.
Yeah.
Yeah, but apart from that, yeah, male doctors tend to be the specialist ones, and the ones that my kids see will be like my son will prefer
Yeah.
a doctor, whereas
Well, I think,
a
yeah. I
female.
think it's just as the it's the just the way the structurally the whole medical system is set up, and also because like it takes years and years, decades of training in order to become a specialist. And you know, that means we're seeing people who went through medical school maybe 20, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, and you know, feminism, guys, it's still like, you know, women are still not given the same kind of
Opportunity.
opportunities, and they're socialized to not center their own ambitions, you know. And so like yeah, it's just like I guess I was going to say it will take maybe a few decades for us to see more specialists who are more like more women specialists. But I don't know if things are changing for the better. Like I think as long as women have babies, we
Yeah, it was super.
As long as we, as long as men cannot get pregnant, we'll always be subtly disadvantaged.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with that. We still haven't done our intro yet. Do you want?
Yeah, that was our intro. This is the Medical Asian Club.
This is Helen.
This is Jess.
And you're listening to Asian Bitches Down Under, where we started our episode this week talking about our own medical experience. Yeah, I have to give a shout out to my local medical center. For anyone who wants to know where it is, you can DM me. But the one that I go to is very, very female lead.
Yeah.
The owner of the clinic is, well, obviously a white female doctor, but she...
And Helen says obviously only because she lives in the Central Coast where most yes. people are white.
White,
keep
yeah.
going, yeah.
But she is, I feel like she is very, she's very dedicated in hiring young GPs with diversity backgrounds. Just in the past 5 years, the interns that came in and the young doctors that she recruit are, I would say, over 70% are from Asia. Like my regular one now, I don't know what's her like ethnic background, but she's I'm guessing she's Southeast Asian, but I don't know, you know, maybe she was born here, but yeah, the ones that I've seen the past 5 years are either from India, okay, with Indian background, mm-hmm. or Sri Lankan background, and they're all young female doctors.
Yeah.
So for me, it was such a safe space. I feel like I can tell them things and don't feel intimidated. You know, sometimes when you have white doctors, they kind of pose themselves as a figure of authority and you don't know how to start a conversation with them.
Yeah. No, that's my whole life until maybe 5 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas I feel like Asian doctors, they give you a sense of a bit more chilled. Yeah. And I don't know. I don't know if our listeners feel the same like me, but I just think that it's a lot more relaxed when I talk to an Asian doctor.
Yeah. We feel a sense of solidarity, even if it's not something we explicitly say, you know, we don't sit down with an Asian and say, hey, you're Asian as well, kind of thing.
Mm. And young ones as well. I think young doctors are more. They don't brush you off.
Oh, I hate, yeah. I think I've actually just like erased them from my mind because they've been awful. But yeah, the number of times I've seen, and you know, in Australia, I feel like when I was younger, like in our 20s, bulk billing was kind of more everywhere. These days, bulk billing's harder to find.
Yeah.
And you know, you go to see a doctor, you don't know them, you go tell them your symptoms. Yeah, the number of doctors, GPs I've seen who are just completely not into their jobs, who even seem to hate people.
Yeah, you
know, it's awful, just so awful. Yeah. And no, we're not dissing older GPs. It's just like, yeah, I know what you mean. Like, I definitely have sensed younger doctors, at least in the same way that I guess a lot of, I know it's not the same, but younger teachers, I feel, often have an exuberance and an energy that older teachers have lost. Not saying that old teachers suck. I know plenty of old teachers, like older teachers who have like the youthfulness of 25-year-old. Mm-hmm. It's just like, very generally speaking, I have also encountered younger doctors to be a bit more receptive and responsive and more energized.
Yeah,
in the clinics.
Well.
They're more thorough.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's our first.
So, Helen, you had a mammogram.
Yeah, the mammogram, yeah, and an ultrasound as well, because just a couple of weeks ago, my GP noticed something a bit abnormal around my breast. She wanted me to go and get a bit more thorough check. So, I had my first mammogram and also the first ultrasound. The result all came out clear, so I'm okay.
Oh, good.
Yeah, so we do encourage, you know, our listeners who are mostly female to go and get a check, regardless if you find something that's, you just feel like it's abnormal, go and get a check. I know that it is costly you still have to pay out of pocket for ultrasound.
Really, you did?
Yeah, it's $200 out of pocket, which is freaking.
Yeah. And so, so do they clamp down your breasts?
Yeah, the X-ray is a machine which is made by Fuji Film. I don't know why. I think it's because, you know, the imaging machines. They're like, I don't know how to describe it. I sent you a photo of the machine, didn't I?
Yeah, you did. Is it as painful as Mum always described it?
No, it just feels tight.
Okay.
Yeah. The first technician I had for X-ray, she was really, really nice.
Okay.
Like, she was really bubbly. Mm-hmm. And the second technician for ultrasound, she reminds me of that character Emily Blunt play in Devil Wears Prada.
She's just a bitch, basically.
No, she was just really sharp, and she just wanted to get her work down, and she didn't really chit chat too much.
Yeah.
The first technicians asked me that, "Oh, is this your first time? Oh, that's so nice. You should treat yourself after this, you know."
Can I just say, those people make the world go round.
I know.
Honestly, so just I want the world to give those people every day some sort of acknowledgement that the tiny little things that they do. Of just making someone's day brighter, just makes the world of difference. Honestly,
it's so important. I think,
honestly,
medical atmosphere that you need to make someone relax because you feel anxious, you know, just like this. Yeah, so she was really nice. Yeah, so that's my first experience. My GP say that the regular checks is usually for women after 50, but when you reach your 40, if you find something abnormal, that is best to get it checked out as soon as possible.
Yeah. Great. Well, I had a busy week, less busy than last week, I feel, but I did, what did I do? Let me just look through my diary. And I've been basically, we've been going through, I feel like there's a lot of gaps in my knowledge when it comes to movies. And
well, I always think that you know a lot.
Oh no, I don't. There's so much I don't know. And over the weekend we started this movie, David Fincher's 1995 film Seven with Brad Pitt and Morgan Freeman. I have never seen that. Helen, have you seen that?
No, I haven't seen that, but I can have that. I have the image of that poster.
Yeah.
Because usually when movie comes out, you see the poster.
Yeah, exactly.
Growing up, we don't see trailers.
yeah. This actually took 3 seatings for me to finish this. Not just because it's so long, but I just couldn't do it for like the first time. We started really late in the night. So anyway, it is such a dark film. I'm sure a lot of our listeners have seen it. It's a classic. I'm kind of troubled by it because, I guess I can't really say it because, Helen, you haven't seen it, so I will have to go through a spoiler. Mind?
I don't mind.
So it's a huge spoiler. So I don't know if you really don't mind or if you're just saying that. But Gwyneth Paltrow is the only female character in the movie. She plays the wife of Brad Pitt. And so Brad Pitt and is a young rookie, not a rookie, he's a young cop who's been assigned to a partner, Morgan Freeman, who is about to retire in 6 days, and they're basically investigating a sleuth of murders, a serial killer. And at the end, Gwyneth Paltrow's head ends up in a box. So it's a famous thing, like a head in a box kind of thing. That's what people usually say when you mention Seven, the head in the box, the twist at the end. I listened to a couple of people on, various film podcasts talk about it. And like, I feel like I spent days after watching the movie feeling very unsettled just because it's a film that...
Violence against women.
It was really, really violent. It's a violent end. And I just didn't think that it was necessary to have the only female character's head end up in a box at the end of the movie for the movie to make its moral statement, I guess. Mm-hmm. It just troubled me a lot. a lot, like deeply, deeply. And just the way that people, film buff people, talk about it, almost elides the whole misogyny or the machinery of misogyny that is Hollywood. And then anyway, it troubled me for days. And then I was just in this mood, you know, when you get through moods, most of my moods lead me to watching rom-coms. But this week I just felt like watching, not because I was depressed or anything, but I just felt like watching dark films. So I followed that up with David Fincher's other classic, Zodiac, from 2007. Have you seen that?
No, I actually haven't heard of this movie.
Oh, really? Okay. Famous movie, Mark Ruffalo, Jake Gyllenhaal. And it's also a very long movie. I found this to be much better in terms of it wasn't as dark. It was much lighter. It didn't hate women as much. Chloe Sevigny, it plays the only female, I guess, kind of, you know, these detective films, these male filmmakers, they always make films about men, centering men, and the only female characters are their wives. Sometimes they end up dead, like Gwyneth Paltrow. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they're just irritating and get in the way of the male protagonists from doing what we want them to do. Like Chloe Sevigny, the way in which she's framed in Zodiac is like the woman who is basically doing what any human being would be, which is to look after their family, you know. So she's married to Jake Gyllenhaal in this movie, and he's investigating a murder, and then he kind of does things that puts their safety in jeopardy, compromises their safety, and at least she doesn't end up dead in the movie. I guess what I wanted to bring up this week is just this, like, my complex feelings around wanting to be a true film buff, in the sense that I want to be able to have seen all the great films in Hollywood, right? But also feeling very uncomfortable because a lot of the films hate women, you know? They hate women actively. They put us in awful situations. They kill us off in terrible, violent ways that you can't separate that made-up world, right, from the fact of our true reality, which is that, absolutely, you know, there is so much violence against us. And like, I feel so complicated feelings about this, because I do agree that David Fincher, David Lynch, you know, Tarantino, all these are great filmmakers. Like, that's an unobjectable fact. And yet I can't, it doesn't feel right to me always to sit through these movies and enjoy them because of just the way in which my gender is hated upon, you know, so actively. And so it's just, I kind of talked about this with people this week, and they were like, can you just like look away during these violent scenes? And I was like, yeah, I can, and I do. Like in Zodiac, for instance, there are a couple of quite violent scenes towards the beginning of the film that I literally just turned away from the screen. Why can't I? Like, it's just, it was so unjust that I can't enjoy a movie while appreciating it in equal measure.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's hard because you always, watching the movie is something that you will try to make a connection of your own life.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know with other people, because some people would want to watch a movie for escapism, or, you know, read a book, or, you know, you want to read or watch something that's very different to your life. But the reason that I don't know what are the real reasons that these male directors make these movies that is so closely linked to our real life. But also, again, these movies are made in, what are they, 90s or 2000s?
2000s. Zodiac was 2007. Mm-hmm. Seven was 1995.
Yeah, so we're talking about like 20 to 25 years ago. So, you know, feminism wasn't that progressive enough yet. And
it still isn't, but yeah, good point.
It isn't, but there is a progress, you know. We don't, you don't see as much of these sort of movies that where female characters are being disempowered or disenfranchised. You know, it, I think our selection of movies in our age now is very different. And back then, like the movies that we, when you were talking about, when you just say the movies about a cop and then where he brought, because of his work, he brought dangers to his family. The first movie I actually, my mind went through was Tripwise.
Again, another movie with exactly the same,
Exactly the same trope. But in that movie, Jamie Lee Curtis's character was kind of been written different to all other female, the wife's character, because she sort of stood up. She actually kind of got involved. Yeah, she looks more empowered.
Yeah. I mean, she's still portrayed as like someone who's like, we're still meant to, I don't know, we're still meant to take Harry's side. Arnold Schwarzenegger's side. That's how I made felt going into the movie. Like, you know, when she went off and had a date with Bill Paxton, we were supposed to be like, oh, how dare she cheat on her husband, kind of thing, you know. I mean, she doesn't, but yeah, it's and then he basically violates her and, you know, kidnaps her, puts her into a interrogation room, and then pretends to be someone else and makes her go through this. I mean, it's pretty fucking
Still very violating, it's still very brutal, yeah. But then it, the way that the movie set out, you can see the humor within it.
I love that movie so much. Yeah, it's a family classic. Yeah. We can quote things from it. It is a fucking classic. So I don't deny you that at all. But yeah, I guess it's just I want someone to teach me how to, it's almost in the same way that I want someone to teach me how to be able to sit through a horror film, because I really respect the genre of horror. I would love to write a horror book one day, and everything about my writing is, a lot of it is informed by movies. And so I feel like I'm missing out on a lot of kind of good ideas or good sort of ways of being through, or like, you know, good commentary by kind of not actively watching horror films. The most horrifying film I've ever seen is like, I can't even say maybe Aliens, you know, like, oh, Alien, not the second one, Alien. But yeah, I can't sit through any stabbing scene at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's way too close to heart for me. Like, I can't separate myself, and like, I get it. It's not real, but, I'd like someone.
It happens maybe, well.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the thing, yeah.
Yeah, maybe I need to be hypnotized or somehow, like, go through some psychotic, need to take some substance in order for me to detach myself from the screen. But I can't do that. So I just want to be able to, I want to be able to sit through, you know, quote-unquote classic films, but not be so disturbed by inherent misogyny in them.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, because it's too close to heart, and if it's real, it's the reality of the world, you know, when you see woman being killed, woman being murdered, to the world. And speaking of horror, I think, like you said, Alien, like, I can watch a movie, and I love watching a movie about zombies, and I love watching TV movies about zombies as well, because the probability of that kind of thing happen is lower, so low compared to a woman being murdered.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, zombie movies are fine. I agree.
That's why you feel like, oh yeah, it's probably never going to happen. So you don't feel like, oh, the horror element is not as much as seeing a woman being murdered.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And can I also say, the way in which violence is enacted also, it makes a difference for me. So I was saying this to a friend this week. I recently went to see John Wick 4, as I talked about, and John Wick 4 has a lot of shooting.
Yeah.
There's a lot, like, I think John Wick's body count per movie is like 150 or something, right?
God. Uh-huh.
And so when someone asked me, like, oh, what about John Wick? How can you sit through that? I think it's because John Wick, and I can say this, and I'm sorry that this doesn't put that this doesn't this isn't the same for our American listeners, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. I'm very sad about that. But in Australia, we don't have the gun laws are different. You know, thank Lord for our government for that. But the reality of gun violence is the reality is in Australia, it's much, much more rare, you know, compared to America. Yes. So when I watch, I can actually sit through John Wick because a lot of it is just, a lot of the deaths that occur are through shooting. And for me in Australia, because of our gun laws, thank God, it's less of a likelihood. It's a less of a real world reality, you know, which made me think, which made me think, Helen, because gun violence is so horrifyingly prevalent in America. Like, I was like, wow, how do Americans sit through John Wick? Because, because mass shootings are so common in the States.
Like, it's up to like 130 or 140.
It's horrifying,
What happened in this week? There's some Christian school.
Yeah, in Nashville. Transgender shooter, a former student. Killed three students and three teachers. It was horrifying. So I guess going back to what we were saying, I think for me it's the method of violence. Like knife stabbings, I can't look at. I don't even want to. I literally block my ears because I don't want to hear the sound. You know, it's so real to me.
I can totally get you and understand how you feel. Yeah.
Hi there. If you're new to our show, thanks for tuning in into our program, and we hope you will stay with us for a very long time. And if you're a regular listener, we're forever grateful for your continuous support throughout this period of uncertainty. It has really helped this podcast to gain a great exposure, as our mission is to center the perspectives of people who look like us, who are marginalized historically to the sideline of conversation. So if you haven't already, we encourage you to subscribe to our podcast on Omni, Apple, Google, or Spotify, and leave a rating and review. And of course, as a small podcast program, we rely on listeners' support to continue this work. Please do check out our Buy Me Coffee page and make a donation in order for us to continue to advocate the intersectionality in the podcast industry.
Speaking of horror films, this week, last Friday, I believe, my husband and I, we watched Get Out. We're so late to this.
I didn't even know that you had never seen it before. It's like shocking.
I was waiting for it to come out onto a streaming platform, and you never did. And I think you only recently came out onto Netflix. So
I didn't even know that. You couldn't not see it. I thought that the whole world had to see it.
Like the people of color in the world, everyone should have seen this already.
I think every white person has seen it. It's a very white person film as well. Like, white people love to say, "Oh yeah, Jordan Peele, Get Out." You know, kind of as a flex. Like, I'm on top of
like
all
the,
that.
Like the white family in the movie as a flex. I would have vote for Obama the third time if I could.
Yeah. The mother is terrifying, mother-in-law.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Get Out was for anyone who doesn't know, which that you should.
No one. You should. You don't even need to talk about it, Helen. Tell us about your reaction.
It's directed by Jordan Peele, who later directed and produced Us and Nope. Both still on my watch list as well.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I still haven't watched those.
Okay, we're canceling this podcast right now.
Bad woman of color, Helen.
No, I'm joking. It's like my student this week was like, I mentioned Succession in my class. And then I was like, and then I said quickly, oh, I haven't seen it. And then he looked at me and he was like, you haven't seen Succession? Yeah, as though like, I don't have a brain. It's like the look he gave me was just like, you haven't watched Succession? Are you fucking nuts? Yeah, I loved it. He's a really great student of mine. I love him. So I thought it was really funny.
Well, anyway, so I want to start talking about this film with the comment that from my daughter before we would start going to watch this film. We were driving home from dinner, and my daughter asked us that if we could watch an episode of Ha Quiz, which is the ABC game show, before she has a shower. And I say, no, it's a bit late. We had dinner outside. So once you get home, you go and have a shower and you go to bed. And she said that, oh, but what about you guys? You guys get to stay up and watch something. And I say, yes, tonight I want to watch Get Out because I've been waiting for so long to watch this movie. And finally, we have the time tonight. And she goes, oh, Get Out? What's the movie about? I said, oh, it's a horror movie. She said, okay, is it about zombies? I said, nah, it's about white people. And she goes, that is horrifying.
Oh, that is so funny.
Literally just roll his eyes because he got used to, you know, us making puns about this kind of
making
thing.
Making jokes about.
Yeah, yeah. But I was laughing my head off. We had fun watching it. My favorite character is his best friend.
Of course. I mean, did you guys have an almost heart attack when the police car rocked up at the end and you were like, oh my god, he's dead? And then, yeah.
You know, my first reaction was,
yeah,
it's going to be a white cop stepping out.
Yeah, of course. That's all we all assume.
Yeah. That's what the director wanted everyone to anticipate. Yeah. But obviously, you know, the friend came in to rescue it in the end.
I need to see that film again. You know why? Because I haven't seen it since I saw it at the cinemas in New York.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
I saw it with a friend in New York. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think my second character that I liked the most, which is very sad to say. I mean, I'm saying...
The girlfriend?
No, I don't really like the older woman in the film. But I really like Bradley Whitford. Yeah, the one who played the white dad. I feel like he's just playing himself. He's just playing a perfect, typical, fake, woke white figure.
Yeah.
You know, those very typical ones. That's what I'm saying, that I feel like he's just playing himself. So Bradley Whitford, he was the guy who played Stephen Sotnan in Tick, Tick, Boom, wasn't it?
Oh, right.
That's how we recognize
him. I'm going to go see that, by the way. It's showing in Sydney. You know that?
Oh, is it?
Yeah. I when I saw the poster for it, I was like, I'm so going there. And I never go to musicals. I'm not a musical kind of person. Mm-hmm. There are people who love musicals and there are people who hate musicals. I'm probably more in the latter group. But I saw Tick, Tick, Boom when it came out because I'm a huge Andrew Garfield fan, and I fucking just that movie killed me. I loved it, and I love the music. It's such good music.
So
I bought tickets to see that, just the cheapest. Things are not cheap, man. Where is the streaming?
Pretty sure it's on Netflix. Yeah.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm probably going to continue my David Fincher filmography this week. Mm-hmm. I think I just want to work my way through all the filmmakers. I'll probably make myself go through a female director next, just to balance it out.
Anything else on your culture?
Oh, yes. So over the weekend, I went into a bookstore across the bridge. I went to shout out to Blues Point Bookstore on Blues Point Road. I never go across the bridge because
shop there.
Why would you? Just kidding. We just lost all half our Sydney listeners. Anyone living in the north? Blues Point obviously is the beautiful little suburb, like at the tip of the bottom of the North Shore. Milsons Point, Kewbilly. There's a bookstore there. I didn't know that either. The woman who runs it is like, her name's Helen. She's great. She's really nice. Mm-hmm. I went in and I was looking for a book. Usually I like to browse, but I went in there being very intentional about what I wanted because my good friend Kelly told me last week that she is looking forward to reading Kate Legg's new book. Oh, you can't see it. It's it's called Infidelity and Other Affairs.
I think I've heard someone mention it. Was it Annabelle Crabb? I'm pretty sure it was Annabelle Crabb and Lee Sales mentioned on their podcast.
Oh, did they? Yeah.
About this book.
What do they say about it? Because Annabelle Crabb did give a blurb about it.
Ah, okay, yeah.
She said, Annabelle Crabb said,
it's memoir about her own affairs, isn't it?
No, her husband cheating.
Oh, her husband. Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah.
So Annabelle Crabb gave a really nice quote and on the cover, but also she gave a hilarious Annabelle Crabb is fucking funny. she says in her shout out, in the middle of it, she says, "It's so gripping that I crashed into a bin while reading it as I walked home from the train." I just found that very hilarious.
Love people who are so immersed in their books. They don't care about the environment.
It's so dangerous, though. It's so dangerous. I would never, yeah.
But it's also such a great compliment because that shows how much that is, you know, the book is so interesting you couldn't put it down.
Yeah, of course, of course. And I love Annabelle. If I ever get asked to do any blurb, I'm going to make sure I say I crashed into a bin. So Kate Legg's book is a memoir about her cheating spouse, basically.
Was she married to this?
She still is. They're not divorced. They have separated and they're both with different partners now. But she just said, Kate has said in interviews that she just can't be bothered getting a divorce, like the logistics, which I actually kind of love. But Kate Legg, if you don't know, I didn't know this until my great friend Kelly told me about. She was a features writer for The Australian. Decades.
The journalist as well.
Which is why I don't know her, because who reads The Australian? It's a really short book. It's a collection of essays, but they're all basically talking about her ideas about whether or not infidelity is hereditary. Because basically what Kate does is she looks through her family history and her husband's family history, and like her husband's father had an affair. Her husband's father's mother had an affair. And like she kind of goes through people in her own family who have had who have committed adultery. And her son had an affair before he got married. Like she says in the scene in the beginning of the book, she says she got called by her soon-to-be daughter-in-law at 3 a.m. and she was crying on the phone saying, "I just found out that your son cheated on me." Kate kind of just talks about, like, the book is very well written. Like, she's like, I don't tend to read a lot of, and I should be ashamed of this, I don't tend to read a lot of books from Australian authors. And this one is actually, this one is very pleasantly and beautifully written. Kate is like in her 60s. She's around our parents' age. And I've actually listened to a couple of interviews with her where she talks about it. And sort of the way in which she talks about it is like it's completely absent of anger or judgment. And something about that, I mean, I've sat with this for a few days now, but initially I was actually quite angry about the fact that she's so chill and so forgiving about the way in which she had been lied to, basically, for so many years in her life. And there was something about the way in which she elevated her sense of complete lack of anger that made me feel like she was saying, oh, if you are an angry person who's been cheated on, you're like kind of like it almost felt like she was saying it's better to not be angry than to be angry, you know, about being cheated on. And I didn't really take it very positively when I heard that, because I am someone who is consistently angry. And I'm not chill, and someone who, like, if something has been done to me that's like, if I've been wronged in some way, I'm not going to be like gracious and forgive someone. I'm going to be like, you know, how do I take my revenge kind of thing, you know? Because I don't know, I just there's just something in the way that she was so forgiving about her husband. Like she said that after she, in one of the interviews she gave, she said that she'd given the first draft to her husband and then he read it and then went for a walk and then came back and then said to her, it's a bit too judgmental. And then she took on that feedback and kind of she said she was grateful for her husband for letting her write this book. And it's just the way in which she was so kind and forgiving towards her husband who had been cheating on her for like years and years. I was just like, why are you so nice? Like, why are you like, it was just like, I don't want women to be nice. I want women to be cutting off people's dicks. You know, if she went and cut off her husband's dick, I'd be like, yeah, like applause. That's what you should do. You know, like, I kind of also admired, like, I've come around to it now because I think I've spoken to a lot of older friends, not a lot, I've spoken to a few very, very special old friends of mine about this anger that I've had. And they've said, you know, like, they've said to me, Jesse, it's a very nuanced thing. Like, she had children with this man. This man stood by her for decades. He was her best friend. Like, these older female friends were like, it's not so black and white. It's very gray, you know, and you will understand this once you get older. And I was like, yeah, okay, I get it. Like, it's nuanced, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, I don't know how the world will get better with just kind women. The world is already full of kind women. You know what I mean? Like, how is the world changing if we just have more women forgiving their husbands for their infidelities, you know?
I think more of a forgiving, well, to me, it's more of she's treating herself the right way rather having that kind of anger consuming her.
Because, yeah, she said she didn't want to be the victim.
Yeah, you can't. How is that anger going to change her husband's behavior? It's not going to change because it has happened. You know, it's his fault. Sorry, my dogs are snoring behind me.
Oh yeah, I thought that was a low fart.
You can't change his behavior. I think it's more of herself forgiving herself. She processed that anger through and there's no point. And it's just going to be detrimental for her own health if she remains angry, I think. That's my assumption. And obviously relationships are never black and white and it's people treat relationships differently and they work it out in the different ways. You know, some people, like, I'm still very curious as in why people seek to have a relationship outside of their own partner or their spouse. I mean, I'm all for polyamorous, but you need to set out the rules, the conditions, and the communications. You need to be very open about it. But if you and your partner has agreed in the monogamy relationship, but then you betray that trust and go on to seek someone else, then that's that person's issue. Yeah. Sorry, my dogs are just like, yeah.
Can you poke them? Wake them up? It's like this low groan in the background.
Yeah. Nobody's ignoring me. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think I remember going to the bookstore and talking to the bookseller and saying, because she had the last copy and I was like, oh, I'm so. She said that she had flipped through it.
Okay.
But we talked about it briefly because we both knew the subject matter.
Uh-huh.
And I was saying like, oh, this is just going to make I feel like so many women are going to try and read it because many of us have, unfortunately, a lot of us have been betrayed by our spouses. Yeah. And like Kate Legg doesn't ever genderize it. Like she never says men commit more adulterous behavior than women. I reckon they do. Like I feel like that's a fact. But she's very kind of diplomatic and she never really blames. She never like only blames men. She says, you know, women also do it. And I feel like myself, infidelity narratives are so fascinating, especially when it's like true stories, because you know why? It's almost in the same way that I used to be obsessed with divorce stories. Like I remember reading Aftermath. And the reason is because I think very irrationally, this is an irrational belief, but there's part of me that feels like if I read more about women who have been cheated on and women who have gone through divorce, I will know and find out the ways of making sure I don't fall for them. You know, like, yeah, so like I was like, I think Kate Legg's book, I was like, maybe she'll talk about what her husband did, and then so I can look for red signs in my own relationship. Like, you know, like it's completely irrational.
Yeah.
And like, thankfully I don't from my knowledge, I haven't been in a relationship where my spouse has been has lied to me, you know. But it's like the way in which I used to, in my 20s, I actively made friends with much older people because I just thought older people could teach me much more than younger people. Like I used to just think I hung out with Barbara for more than, you know, 200 hours in my life. You know, I went on holidays with Barbara Barbara is like a woman in her 80s. I met when I was in my early 20s, and she was a big, huge figure in my life all through my 20s. And then I lived with a woman who was in her 60s for like 2 years in my 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I just felt like older people had more interesting things to say about life, and also could teach me more kind of wise things about like what to do with my life and what to avoid. You know, it's kind of with that same lens that I seek out stories about women who have been hard done by men, you know.
Well, the thing is, relationships are very unpredictable and people change. Like, I don't like people saying that my partner will never do this or my partner will never do that.
I think that's dangerous.
It will hurt you more when you're something really.
Yeah, happens. Because Kate Legg says this. She's like, when she found out her husband had been having years of adulterous behavior, she was said that she was like completely floored and completely just like her stomach, all the air from her stomach was like expelled because she was just so shocked. And I think it's dangerous to think that you know your spouse. I would never think that to know someone completely, because I think any form of certainty in life is a dangerous thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think especially within trust, within relationship. I'm not saying that you can't trust your partner, but having such an absolute expectation is a danger to not only your relationship, but also to yourself as well. It's very detrimental for your own health that you have that kind of expectation. And if something does happen out of your expectation, out of your own control, I think that's going to be like the worst feeling. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so moving on to another cultural consumption. I just want to quickly mention we watched Bullet Train, another
piece. Oh, yes. You know, I saw that on Binge the other day. YouTube Binge, right?
I think we watched on Apple TV.
Oh, okay.
On Apple TV. I can't remember now. Anyway.
I want to see that. I love Aaron Johnson.
Another movie that we are late to watch, very whitewashed narratives, because it's based on a novel by a Japanese author, Kotaro Isaka. So the Japanese, I'm not quite sure if I mentioned it in our previous episodes, because I listened to the audiobooks way back, probably beginning of last year. So the Japanese original name is Maria Beetle. It's a black humor thriller about conflicts between assassins and hitmen of the underground Yakuza world of Japan. Brad Pitt's codename was Lady Bug, this character who plays a hitman as well, who runs into bad luck when he's on a mission and always accidentally kills someone. It's a fun movie to watch, but it's really, really whitewashed. Yeah, because it's based in Japan, and all the characters from the novel are supposedly to be all Japanese, but they inserted in the movie, they inserted white characters in it, and there's only two female characters who are also playing assassins, and the one who played a specific assassin who uses like poison to kill people, she's a woman of color, and she only appeared like 5 minutes in the film and she dies. The book is definitely better. I listened to the audiobook. I think the audiobook was very interesting because the narrator really amplified the particular storytelling tone of voice. You know, sometimes you read it yourself, you don't get that kind of feeling, but when someone reads to you, they read it with emotion. It's more fun. Yeah, so it was more exciting from the book, and they cut a lot of bits out in the movie that I thought was a bit disappointing. But after all, it's a fun movie to watch if you just want to watch, you know, something that doesn't really use much of your brain cells. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah.
Okay, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, what are we going to talk about this week, Jess?
We're going to talk about married women who win the lottery and then quickly divorce their husbands and why.
Okay, we'll be right back.
Okay, so we're back. This week I had the privilege of covering an interesting topic, a story coming out from Switzerland, a study by the Swedes along with some help from the Americans. A study that basically looked at Swedish lottery winners.
Mm-hmm.
And what they did was they compared women and men, like who were married, and the way that what happened to their lives after they won the lottery. And what the study found was that married women who won the lottery were far more likely to divorce their spouses than men who won their lotteries, who won lottery, and which kind of, it was so interesting to me because it spoke a lot about the way in which women lead their lives when they come into some sort of positive wealth acquisition, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was that they found that it's kind of a little misleading what I said, because the study actually made a point of noting that winning the lottery as a woman didn't actually directly cause or lead to divorces. It just accelerated them for women who were already thinking about filing for divorce. Mm-hmm. What's interesting, Helen, though, is that men who won the lottery, they actually their divorce rates were much lower.
Mm-hmm.
And also a lot of them ended up getting married if they weren't married already. So, and also having more children.
Mm-hmm.
And so not only were the male winners much more likely to get or stay married, they also ended up having more children. And the trend was consistent regardless of whether the man was married or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it kind of made me think about all the kind of ideas I have about why it is the man who proposes to the woman,
mm-hmm.
you know, like historically, because men's lives are easier married, you know, with a wife. And whereas, for a woman, like there's a reason why women don't propose to men, right?
I think
you know what I mean?
This is socially expected that men propose to women. And socially expected that man takes care of woman. I mean, conservatively, and in the sense of monetary.
Is there something happening outside?
No.
Oh, I could just hear like some. Okay. Anyway,
yeah.
Go on.
Yeah, and I think it's socially expected that man looks after woman financially. I guess.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You marry, you know, and obviously that's changing. But I do wonder, how do they do this kind of survey? Do they go out and ask lottery winners
I think they...
What's your marital status?
No, they track lottery winners. Okay. That's what they do, yeah. And they also found that men get married faster after winning lottery. I think it's because, like, for men, they become more attractive once they get richer, whereas it's not the same for women, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I just find that so interesting, just the way in which you can come into the same gift, I guess, mm-hmm. you know, but your life will take very different turns depending on your gender.
Gender, yeah.
So, you know, coming into a lot of wealth for women means you leave a relationship that you're not really satisfied with. Whereas, like, for a man, it's like they get into or they attract more partners because of their wealth acquisition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wonder if it's, it says that the study says that it accelerates the woman's decision of getting out of a marriage, like having the
divorce.
Because there's a financial stability once you win.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, lottery, obviously that you're sick of this relationship and the only thing that you're remaining with the husband is probably because there's a certain income that you have and then you can still, you know, have a roof over your head. But now once you win the lottery, you're unsatisfied with this relationship. Why not? You know, like I can move out, I can have my own life and I don't have to look after anyone else. So there's an incentive definitely for the woman when they are already thinking of getting divorced. Whereas men, they will probably think that having more money, okay, this is my assumption. I'm not saying that it applies to all men, but my assumption is that when I have more money, I attract more women, therefore higher likelihood of having an affair or something like that, because they probably don't have to work as much. They don't have to work as long hours when you suddenly have
a lot of money.
A lot of money, yeah. And what are you going to do with that money? You're going to go out and have fun, and you are going to get yourself satisfied in every way possible.
Yeah, food, sex, property.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so I'm assuming that's the one of the reasons, I'm guessing. And also, I don't think the society as a whole hasn't progressed enough, because I remember seeing what you wrote about this study is that at the end of the day, it's still very difficult for women who are very successful in her career. I mean, there's a rate of between men and women that when a woman gets promotion, there's higher likelihood of her
divorce,
you know, or if she's earning higher, if she has a higher income than her husband, there's a higher likelihood of divorce as well. I think, I don't know the real reason behind that, but I'm guessing that partially, or maybe for someone, that the husband feel like their pride has been outperformed. I mean, their achievement been outperformed by their female partner, and very what's the word I'm looking for? It's a very
intimidated.
Men
are intimidated.
Yeah, they feel intimidated. It's a very outdated sort of perception that my wife cannot be better than me. I feel like there's a sense that still a lot of cis men out there feel that way. Yeah, I hope the trend is changing, because if that doesn't change, you can't expect men to do other sort of work that are still very female dominated. Yeah. I mean, that's the whole different topic. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that's all I have for today.
So I guess, you know, divorce rate and woman winning lottery, it's just not only winning lottery. I'm guessing that sometimes if you just receive suddenly inheritance, you know, from unknown relatives or something like that, you know, external income that's unexpected would that lead to an acceleration of divorce rate? I'll say yes, because, you know, like I said before, having the financial stability in this world, this day, is very important. And if a marriage is, we still think, well, personally to me, I think marriage is still a very constrained institution for women. So if you have that freedom, why not, you know, you don't have to put up with the bullshit in your life. So I guess that's why differences between women and men and winning the lottery, how they make the decision about their own relationships. Okay, anything else from you?
No.
Okay, that's the end of our episode. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Google, and Apple, and give us a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support us, what we do here at Asian Bitches Down Under, head to Buy Me Coffee page to make a donation for us to continue the intersectionality in the podcast industry. So that's it from us this week, and we'll chat to you next time.
Bye.